I don't want to die without making a movie. And if five people watch it, I don't care. I want to make a movie.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Mostly Harmless. This week, I'm excited to introduce you to a very special guest. This week, we are hanging out and chatting with director Scott Barber. Scott is the director of the most excellent documentaries, The Orange Years, a documentary about the golden days of Nickelodeon and how it changed children's entertainment forever. Also, a very different documentary, Scott is also the director of the upcoming GWAR documentary, This is GWAR, hitting Shudder on July 21st. Scott, how the hell are you? It's so nice to electronically meet you.
Right. I'm doing awesome, man. Thank you so much for having me on the show. Thanks for the kind words about the Nickelodeon documentary and for pumping up the GWAR documentary. Yeah. And I hope you're doing well, too.
Yeah, it's been a lovely, July 6th afternoon, whatever. I've just been, I don't know about you. I get really nervous before doing interviews. So mostly today I've been pacing back and forth around the apartment, just writing down all my notes, talking to myself and just kind of getting ready, listening to interviews with you. I've listened to your voice a lot today. You've been doing the last couple of years. You've done a hell of a lot of press, haven't you?
Yeah. For the Nickelodeon one, I did a bunch because, you know, with Shudder, it's so awesome. They're doing all the press and all the promo and everything for us. But, we had a distributor, like a middleman with the Orange Years, which was awesome, you know. But we had to do a lot of the press. And also, it first was on like iTunes and Amazon. Now it's on Hulu. So people are finding out about it a lot easier. But when it's just on iTunes and Amazon for rent, you have to find that particular movie. You're not just browsing. We had to really promote the heck out of it so people would rent it for those first 3 months before it was on Hulu. So yeah, I did a bunch.
Yeah. My favorite thing is I actually bought it on Vudu. I think it was like $8.99 or $7.99. And the very next day popped up right up on Hulu. It was like, you might be interested in this. And I'm like, oh. I am happy to support this film because it is really great. But yeah, you did do a lot of press. Are you not doing that much for the GWAR documentary this time around?
No, yeah, I plan on doing it as much as I can. We had just started. I have a producer, Bill Parks, that worked with me on both. And it's funny, he's an actor and he's very charismatic and good at speaking. And I'm always like, you need to do these, man. You're an actor. But he just books me on them constantly. He just books. So he's starting to book me on a bunch of these here.
Well, I've listened to you a lot in the last couple of days, just getting ready to chat with you, and you're really good at it. You're a natural guest. Let me ask you, it's not often I get to talk to people who do interviews. Do you do the interviews for the movies yourself, or do you have somebody come along with you and help facilitate those?
I just do it.
You just do it. How do you prepare for those? Do you wander around the apartment with ADD really badly like I do, trying to figure out what you're going to say, or how do you get into these interviews?
It's funny, I have hardcore ADHD, not to get off on a heavy sidetrack.
Let's do it.
But I just, I started taking medication for it and it's been super life-changing. So I'm doing a lot better with stuff like that now.
I've got my vape pen here, which I consider medication. So.
Yeah, anything that kind of fidget, anything to kind of do that, it takes a lot of that edge off. But I mean, no, I just kind of, I'm really passionate about things. And, you know, whenever I'm being asked questions about documentaries and stuff, it's something I've been doing for a year. So I'm like very well versed in the subject that we're going to talk about, you know, so I don't really have to prepare that much because I've been studying for a year. It's only when people will throw me a real curveball that has nothing to do with the documentary or something like that, that I'm like, oh, that's hard, you know, but yeah, I hope that answers the question.
Sure. Well, so I'm going to jump around all over the place. Yeah. I have so many notes here, but ADD, so we'll see where it goes. Again, I don't get to talk to too many people about, I've always wanted to make documentaries. My way of doing it, I guess, is doing this little podcast where I decided I wanted to be the quote unquote punk rock drunk version of Marc Maron years ago. And it's been a hell of a ride. And I got really close to being involved with the Blasting Room documentary that's about to come out. But I wasn't in the right. It was the wrong place. I just couldn't commit to it. So
yeah.
But unfortunately, they've got some really great people who did step up and help make that. So my real goal today is just to become your best friend forever. And you and I work on documentaries forever in the future. So we'll see. Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'm doing okay so far with my meandering and rambling. Anyway.
So far, great.
So I just want to know, like, we both grew up. I'm from Shreveport, Louisiana.
Oh,
you're
cool.
From what, Houston?
Mm-hmm.
We both kind of came up, like, you played in pop punk bands. I went to a lot of pop punk shows. And then in that time, it was really hard to find that kind of stuff. How old are you?
40.
40. I'm going to be 41 next month. So we're about the same age.
Yeah.
Nobody ever played in Shreveport. So we had to go seeking that stuff out. And a lot of times I spent a lot of time in Deep Ellum. In Dallas, going to like Trees, Galaxy Club, Deep Ellum Live, places like that. But you spent a lot of your time in Houston or in that area?
Yeah, Houston, Dallas, a little Austin. And how did you know that? I don't talk about that a lot.
I listened to a lot of interviews, man.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it was a long time ago, but we would book these little tours and stuff like that. We did better when we were out of Houston than when we were in Houston. Because, you know, people are like, oh, you know, you're just some local band, who cares? And we weren't one of the like local darlings, so nobody really cared. But then we'd play other places and people thought because we were a touring band, we were something, but we weren't. You know, we would just call places. You know, we would go all the way across to, you know, El Paso and through Arizona to LA and then up to San Francisco. And then sometimes up to Lake Tahoe and then back down, and we would just book tours and just do it like that, make no money, but we would be either sleeping in the car or sleeping on people's floors or whatever. So it was a great, fantastic experience to get to do that, you know, and a lot of people I think thought that they couldn't, you know, you had to have a label or something like that to do it, but we just did it, you know, we made no money, but also it didn't cost us any money. So we got to see the country at a young age and be with our best friends, you know, when we were super young. So it was a fun experience. But and it's funny because that mentality is why I think I've been successful as a filmmaker, that punk rock mentality.
Yeah, I definitely like I did zines out of Shreveport, mostly the shows in Shreveport. We would have to drive to Longview, Texas, which had a VFW hall that threw some really great shows there, like Tsunami Bomb. Even now, when I read interviews with Tsunami Bomb, are like, that was our favorite venue to play. Did you guys ever play Longview at all? That little VFW hall with Tyler, Texas?
I don't think we did. Yeah. But it's funny you say that. My old band played with Tsunami Bomb a couple of times. And now the drummer for that pop punk band back in the day, he's their tour manager.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, whenever they came through Houston, we would do that too. We would set up shows at a community center where we would just rent it out, and we would pack it out because we would charge, you know, $5 or whatever, and you could see four or five bands. We would all the big high schools. We would always book one from all the different high schools, say to all bring all their friends, and then have a touring band, and you know the local Houston club that a lot of the punk and metal bands would play, it's not open anymore, so I can say this, would screw the bands. I mean, they were one of those pay to play, and they would pay you off of how many people you brought in. Well, if you're a touring band that's not big, how many people are you going to bring in? So we would then ask those bands that were bigger, you know, like Tsunami Bomb, that wasn't like, you know, a radio band, but they were pretty big.
They were big to us.
They were big to us, you know, and we would ask them, hey, do you want to play this community center thing? We can pay you, you know, a good amount. So all these touring bands ended up really liking us. And that's how we got shows, because they all loved us, even if they might probably weren't a fan of our band or whatever, but we would treat them right. Every time they would come through, we would be like, if this other club screws you, which we know they will, come play over here. Cause we were about 20 minutes outside of Houston. So they'd make no money at the cool hip downtown club and then play at a community center and just make a bunch of money and get to sell a bunch of merch. It was awesome.
The VFW Hall Community Center thing, it doesn't really happen anymore. And it's a big bummer. Like I just recently moved to Napa, California, and I'm like, where are all the DIY shows? And I got lapped at. They're like, this is Napa. That doesn't happen here. But I'm like, it could happen here. Mm-hmm. But I love that DIY spirit. I had a little bit of that in, you know, my days, and writing about bands led to booking shows. But also writing about bands, like really, I grew up on a steady diet of Wizard magazine and, you know, like BMX Plus, Trans World. But the things I really loved were reading the interviews and profile pieces. And that really did translate into the stuff that I'm still doing today. So it's really cool to see that all that DIY work you were doing then really built the foundation for this career that you're still doing and still thriving. Did you ever, like, how does one get the balls to make a movie? Like that takes a lot of balls to do. And I don't know if I necessarily have those balls yet. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, is I'm like, how do you do it? Like, can you inspire me, please, to make a movie?
Yeah,
maybe we can inspire some others.
Maybe so. Well, you know, I just wanted to do it. That was one of the things. I was like, I don't want to die without making a movie. I want to make a movie. And if 5 people watch it, I don't care. I just want to, at the end of the day, even if I only make one, even if it doesn't go anywhere, I want to be able to check that off of my list as I made a movie. And, you know, I think everybody, when they want to make their first movie, they want to get this big budget, you know, they want to write a script and sell it and have all this magical stuff happen. And because of the punk rock stuff, I just said, I don't want to do that. I just want to make a movie that even if nobody helps me, can get made. I'm not going to have to worry about anybody else. And I worked on The Orange Years with a friend named Adam Sweeney. We were the co-directors of that. And, you know, we had kind of worked on random projects together, and he had a job where he hired me to do some like interviews with some people at this company. It was just a total corporate gig, you know, what I was doing at the time to, you know, make money. And I still do, because I'm not making a bunch of money with documentary films. But, you know, we had talked about trying to make movies, and we were kind of thinking of that way too, trying to sell a script or whatever, get a producer to invest, you know, hundreds of thousand dollars. And then I was like, we should just make a documentary, you know, because then we can make it and we don't need any help. We're already kind of doing it. You know, I would go film these people at his job. He was a marketing guy. He's a really great like marketing PR guy. So he would kind of do that. He'd book the interviews. I would, I'd film them, I'd edit them. And I was like, we could totally make a documentary. And then, you know, we had some friends that had made a documentary called The Prequel Strike Back, which is pretty cool, because it was about how, hey, we all know the prequels suck, but let's just take another look at them, you know? And it's kind of cool, because since then, the prequels, I feel like, are kind of getting a little more love. Like, people are kind of starting to come around. Not all the way, but like, you know, they're all right. They had some spirit to them. They had heart. But anyway, you know, those guys had made it, and they had crowdfunded it, and they got a good amount of money. And I knew, if we did a documentary and we crowdfunded it, we could make enough money, because obviously there's so much that we can do. I can shoot. I know how to shoot. I have all the camera equipment. I know how to edit. I can do all this stuff, but there's certain stuff that we need money for, like travel and legal fees and all that bull crap that we just need money for. So we're like, if we can just do a crowdfund for that, that would be awesome. And so we said, okay, well, what would be a cool topic to do a crowdfund for that people would resonate with? You know, because we saw the Star Wars community gave the guys that made Prequel Strikes Back so much money. And we thought, you know, no one's going to give us money, because we've never made a movie. It's not like, oh, did you hear about that new Scott Barber film? Let's go crowdfund it. So we were like, what can we make a documentary that would resonate with people and we could do a crowdfund for? But more importantly than that, we don't want to do it just for a crowdfund. We don't want to be soulless and just go, oh, we can make a bunch of money. So we were like, what are we passionate about? What's something that's pretty cool that also hasn't been done? That was the big thing, hasn't been done. Yeah. And, you know, Adam and I, Nickelodeon was real important to both of us. You know, we had been friends since we were 11 years old back in the 90s, and we watched a lot of those shows. And so we said, hey, let's make a Nickelodeon documentary. That sounds pretty cool. And as I started researching it, we were like, there's this actual story here. You know, at first we're like, we can't just do a documentary and show a bunch of old shows. There's got to be some sort of story there. And once we found out about Jerry Laybourne, we're like, okay, it's something that people will be passionate about that has an audience. It's something that we can make and we're passionate about. And it's something that has a story. So we really just dove in headfirst, like threw caution to the wind. And it's kind of cool that I didn't know what it takes to make a documentary like I do now. Now I'm more scared than I was back then. I was like, oh, screw it. We can make a documentary. And really so much could have gone wrong. But, you know, you take that, the way I kind of like, the analogy I use is like pushing a car. You know, when you first push it, it's really hard. And then it starts getting easier and easier and easier. And then you can just push it with your finger and just walk with it, you know, once you get that momentum. And that's what happened. You know, we crowdfunded it for $12,000. That's it. Yeah. And we didn't know anybody at Nickelodeon. So it's not like we had an inside track. I think back, I'm like, what if we couldn't have booked any interviews? What if people had just said, I don't want to be a part of this documentary that these two dudes from Texas that have never made a movie that did this goofy crowdfund. I don't want to do it. We had no hookups at all, but we, you know, once we got one person, then another person, then they told three or four more of their friends, these guys are cool. It's a fun time. You should do it. More and more people got excited about it. And then more and more producers started coming up to us because we booked all these interviews. You know, we had Mark Summers, we had Elisa Reyes, Lori Beth Denberg, you know, all those like faces from Nickelodeon. And then we cut a little teaser trailer together. And then we got some producers to come on board. And then we got Adam F. Goldberg to come on board as an executive producer. And that was like the last one that was like, okay, awesome. And then once he came on, he helped us out. He basically was like, what do you need? What do you need to finish this thing? And from what I found out about him, this is how cool that guy is. Because he obviously doesn't need money and all that stuff. He just finds cool documentaries and helps people and doesn't take any money, doesn't ask for anything. He just likes to be a part of these indie documentaries. And so he just said, what do you need? And he just helps people finish. You know, he's not going to come in and do the work for you from the beginning, but he just said, what do you need? And he was so gracious with his time. He let us film on the set of the Goldbergs for a couple of interviews. And he booked a couple of interviews for us that we could not get, the bigger ones. And then he hooked us up, you know, he helped us find distribution. So he helped us out immensely, you know? So then at the end, it was easy to book people. It was easy to make stuff happen. And then when we needed a little bit more money to finish it, it was easier to find investors because we had built up this buzz. And then we got in a film festival, Doc NYC, and then we got an agent and all that stuff happened. There were a lot of pitfalls that happened. Yeah. A lot of pitfalls, and it's all on the business side, which sucks because, you know, that's the side that you can't be punk rock about. You kind of have to let other, it was once we let it go, some weird stuff happened, but yeah, that was it. You know, I guess I had the balls because I was stupid and just didn't know what I was doing and it worked out for me. And then I learned how to do it. So then with Guar, I was able to be a lot smarter and make things happen in a more efficient way.
Yeah. That really is. That's whenever I do, because I'm still like a nervous at 40 years old. Like I've done a lot of like, screw it. I'm just going to go do it. But I'm still always nervous the whole time. But everybody I talk to is like, it's just, I didn't know how hard it was going to be. And I just went for it anyway.
Yeah.
What was it like to find out that you were actually kind of talented at this kind of thing? Like, when did you figure that out? Or did you figure that out?
It's weird because I had to find out what my talents are because there's so many different things about making a documentary and
or even just making art in general. There's finding your talent can be I have so many fucking talents. It's hard to figure out what to do with them all. So congrats to you for figuring this part out.
Well, I've always kind of figured myself like that, like a jack of all trades, master of none lot. But then I found with indie filmmaking that actually helps because you can wear so many different hats. Like I shot some of the interviews on both of them. I edited a lot on the Orange Years. I did music on both, not the main music, but I recorded songs for both. I booked interviews for both. I booked locations for both. So I think all those skills I'm pretty good at. And then I'm able to, do it a little bit and then find people who are better than me to take it to the next level. Like with the Orange Years, I didn't, you know, we were able to get a really great editor. His name is Bradford Thomason. And he did a really awesome show, his Pizza Doc. And then he did a Glow documentary. And then he did one called Jasper Mall that's just phenomenal. And then he just did a Reading Rainbow doc. It premiered at Tribeca. It's going to do some big things. But he's like a legit, real awesome editor. And, you know, because I was able to not just give him a bunch of footage, because that's the hardest thing about a documentary is you make the story at the end. You know, like you have an idea for what you want to do, but really the editing is where you do it. You know, you think it's easier to make a documentary, and on the production end, it is. You know, you're filming an interview. If you have one or two people and a good camera, a light and a microphone, you got it. But it's all that post-production work. And so, you know, the fact that I was able to shape it up and get a pretty okay looking film and then pass it off to him to make it look awesome was really helpful. Whereas if I had not known how to edit at all and I just gave him, you know, 50 hours of footage and was like, turn it into something, you know, I would have had to pay a lot of money. And it would have been really rough. And, you know, because I'm able to, you know, I shoot myself and I do audio and I'm good on with production. I'm able to work with a cinematographer and kind of help them. It's weird. I don't know if you remember The Office, where it's like the assistant to the assistant regional manager, where Dwight is both Jim's boss and Jim's assistant. That's kind of what I am. I'm like the director, so I'm in charge. But then I'm also the assistant to the camera guy because I'm like, you get the shot and tell me what you need. So I'm not having to pay for three or four more guys. Like I kind of do all the, I'll set up the B cam shot. I'll set up the audio. I'll set up the lights for him and then go back to being a director. But I think my real talent though is finding talent and being able to see the big picture and knowing what I need to do and finding people that are have potential that haven't you know, I'm not brown nosing people that are bigger than me to try to help me. I can find people that are, that haven't done it yet, but I know can do it and are talented and can do it and find them, I guess, putting all the pieces of the puzzle together, you know, like with the Orange Years, you know, Bradford had already done some stuff, but I was able to convince him to work with me. And then Jacob Halinga, he shot a bunch of the interviews for the Orange Years and then was the director of photography for Guar. And he was a young guy. And I met him through a punk rock guy from back in the day. But then, and you know, the guy that did the music for the Orange Years, his name's Darren Beck. He's in an awesome band called Pinkish Black. They're from Dallas, but they're this weird, they get booked with stoner rock bands, but they have no guitar player. It's just a keyboard player and a drummer. They sound kind of like a mix between the Melvins and Twin Peaks. But I knew his name is Darren and I knew he could do the music, because if you listen to the Orange Years, one thing that I think makes it so awesome is every segment has a different style of music. Like when we play Hey Dude, there's like cowboy type music. And then when we do like Nick Arcade, it's like computer sounding music. And then there's some 80s music. And then there's some like rock and roll music. And then there's some kind of John Carpenter stuff for when we talk about Are You Afraid of the Dark. And I knew he could do that. I knew he could do all these different things. And so the fact that I was able to think of him instead of just like, oh, who's a film score guy? He's not a film score guy. He never scored a film before, but he did it. And he did it way better than a lot of people that have been doing it for years could have done. So yeah, I think that's my overall talent, is just the fact that I can do a bunch of things and then find people to take it home. Yeah. I'll get you 75% there and you take it home, and I can find people and put a team together. I think that's, I guess, what I'm best at.
Nice. No, that's incredible. I feel like I recently was a restaurant manager in a past life, and a lot of my job was like stealing people from my previous restaurants. And we put together a really good team. And unfortunately, that's a whole different other thing.
Yeah.
So it's cool. I don't I never thought of that as a, you didn't use the word superpower, but I am, but it's real interesting. Cause I like to put people together. I like to be like, hey, you do video. You're a cool dude. You run a brewery, a punk rock band brewery. Let's get you guys together. And all of a sudden there's a video series going that I helped, you know, anyway, that enough about me, but it's real cool. Like, thank you. I'm
learning. I think it's an ADHD thing, you know, like the fact that ADHD, we're both, our brains are going a bunch of different ways. So we're able to see the big picture and do a bunch of different things. And then you find somebody who's like focused, you know, I always try to pair myself with someone who's the opposite, you know, who is like, I can just sit here and do this one task and do it really well. And I'm not even going to be thinking about this guy is the guy that's thinking, I'm just editing. I'm not even thinking about filming or legal or selling it. I'm just editing. And then when you can find people like that, it's like, you got it all.
Cool. Well,
which kind of like what you do, it sounds like, you know, you put these guys together. Hey, you're really good at a brewery. You're good at a video. So
I just wish I had money to do it. Like, cause you need money to like,
I know.
Stuff. And I don't have any,
that's what sucks.
I'm working three jobs right now. And I'm like, where's the money? Where's the money to make these projects happen? I guess maybe I need a GoFundMe, but man, it is so nice to talk to somebody who's on just like a similar wavelength. And you're giving me things that I can be like, okay, maybe I, cause right now I just moved to this town. I'm trying to figure out what I'm doing, who I am, what I'm going to do. And I'm 41 years old, midlife crisis time, prime time for it. Mm-hmm. And so I definitely want, I quit doing all this interview stuff for years and years and years. And now I'm trying to get back into it because I spent so much time honing this voice, but it's like, what do I do with it now? And you're giving me a great example of a place I can take it. So thank you.
Oh, thanks.
Now, where do we take that into something that listeners actually want to listen to? But what I love is, you know, just listening to your story, it's like you, here's the thing I was just thinking. My girlfriend's huge into astrology. I've been asking this recently every episode, and I asked somebody this the other day, and it turned out we had the same birthday. So I was just curious, what's your sign? What's your birthday? What's the deal there?
My birthday is December 19th.
Okay. We don't have the same birthday, but that's a great day. My best friend has that birthday, Sean.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a cusp. I'm a Sagittarius Capricorn cusp, I found out. So I don't know what that means, but I guess I'm a mixture of the two.
Yeah. No, I don't believe in it, but my girlfriend does. And then there's some bizarre similarities between people. And
it's just
a fun like curiosity to throw in there.
Yeah.
And then tackle on that we grew up at the same time, similar enough-ish eras. Anyway, it's just real interesting to see. It's like, oh, I can do this too. But let's talk DIY, because Guar, we're here really today to sell this Guar documentary and sell more subscriptions to Shudder, which I fucking love Shudder. One of my all-time favorite apps. I'll go months without even looking at it, and then I'll spend nothing. I'll spend a month watching everything. Joe Bob.
So good.
Psycho Gorman. All these like really, and they've really been really kind to a lot of the indie films. What is it like coming into their home, so to speak? You know, what is it like coming under their umbrella?
It was awesome. Like, it was so awesome. Very beginning, they were awesome. You know, because originally, so my thing about the Guar documentary is I wanted it to appeal to everybody. You know, because their story appeals to everybody, not just metal people, not horror people. None of that. So I thought that the sky was the limit, not even because of anything I was doing, just because their story is so bonkers and visually it's so crazy. So originally, you know, when we were thinking about Shudder, it's like, but then that's kind of niche. You know, I want to get this out there to people that, you know, their favorite band is Garth Brooks and now they're a Guar fan. Cause I think that could happen.
Well, I saw a very great YouTube review today where that young man discovered the film and was like, I don't know what the hell I just watched, but I loved it.
I love that. That's my favorite thing whenever I hear people say, I've never heard of these guys before, because I feel like I'm helping Guar, because they've helped me so much. They were awesome. The whole thing has been a damn pleasure because they were awesome to work with, and now Shudder's awesome to work with. We debuted at Fantastic Fest. With the Alamo Drafthouse, who's now giving us a theatrical run. Wow. They were awesome. So it's really been cool. But yeah, whenever I hear that, I love it. I love hearing people be like, I've never heard of them. I'm not even into that kind of music, because we never approached it as a rock doc, like ever. We never thought of it as a metal doc, a rock doc. There's that stuff is in there, but it was never that to me. It was never, it's a story of just some people that are awesome and go through hell and back and never give up hope. And are triumphant and are just awesome and follow their dreams. Like we're talking about, you know, it's inspiring. Yeah. No matter what it is, if you've had a dream, you can be inspired by this. If you've ever suffered immense tragedy and you came out the other side, no matter what it is, drug addiction, loss, anything, you can be inspired by these guys. But I know you were talking specifically about Shudder.
Oh, I was, we're just talking, whatever. So we can.
But yeah, I mean, it's hard for me not to talk about how wonderful the whole experience has been, which is funny. Of all the people that would treat you the best, it's a bunch of people that dress up like monsters and want to destroy the human race, yeah. Kill them and squirt cum on them in blood. And this has been the best experience I've ever had. And then Shudder, a company that sells movies about stuff like that. But from the moment at first, you know, we were like, we really wanted it to be on a platform that was more, yeah. You know, not as niche. But the moment we talked to people at Shudder, we're like, oh, this is it. Cause they respected GWAR. And I love that. They were like, we love you. We respect GWAR. They understood the value that, yes, they're horror, but they're horror adjacent. They knew that they would bring new people and they respected them for that. They were going to treat them right. Like, we know our fans will like you guys because you have the horror element, but you'll bring your fans that are new. And they respected what they did. They want to do more stuff than just the documentary. The sky's the limit. They're talking outside of me. Now Shudder and GWAR is connected and they're talking about doing all sorts of stuff.
Oh, I can't.
And so they respect them. And then they respected us as filmmakers. They've been super helpful, super awesome. And I will say another thing that is pretty cool for people who, you know, maybe are on the fence about Shudder. It's also going to be on AMC Plus, because AMC is the parent company. And so no matter what you want to do, if you want to get a free trial to Shudder, or if you want to get a free trial to AMC Plus, so you can see more stuff, you know, do that. They're both awesome services. But yeah, they've been awesome. You know, the Nickelodeon documentary, we had a lot of really bad experiences selling that. And so that's why, and we got taken advantage of by a lot of people. So that let me know how awesome Shudder is, because I don't take that for granted, because I've seen the other end of the spectrum. Yeah. And to see someone that's not taking advantage, that's trying to lift up the community and help and actually treat filmmakers like they deserve and the subjects like they deserve, was really a breath of just fresh air. So we're really excited to be working with Shudder and also the Alamo Drafthouse.
Yeah. I just want to kiss Shudder's butt real quick. Like I don't have, like, my show is not a big show. It's a little show, but when I approached Shudder and asked them, you know, like, hey, can I interview the Hellbender guys or this band or this movie, they're always very accommodating. Like, they recognize that, you know, they play Moneyball is the reference I'm going to use as a baseball metaphor to describe a horror movie streaming network. But they know that, like, maybe two or three people might listen to this and then keep spreading like, yeah, a virus. So I really appreciate everything they do, and I've discovered a lot of really, really awesome stuff because of what they do. And I was really excited when I saw that you guys were gonna have this on there, because I knew that they would bring that level of that word that I can't think of. But anyway, so man, where do we go from here? Now we're talking about Shudder, we're talking about GWAR. Oh, I was gonna ask, I've interviewed GWAR before. It ended up with them fondling my very nice sized man boobs and pouring beer all over me while we talked about, God, I don't even remember. The interview wasn't important. It was them, quote unquote, sharing their beer with me all over my shirt and face and everything.
Oh my God.
While playing with my boobs. What was your experience like working with GWAR? You've already said they were sweethearts, but did you ever get to see any of that side while you were working with them?
You know, a little bit, but not a lot. So I'm assuming when you interviewed them, they were in character.
Oh, they were very much in character. Yes, this was backstage at Riot Fest in Denver. So they were very much in character, having a good time.
And that was the cool thing about this doc. And I think what people will like is, or one thing that I hope they like, this is the human side of Gwar. And that, because for so long, they only did interviews in character, you know, kind of like how Pee Wee Herman, you know, he would always, Paul Rubens didn't exist, you know. So they've started doing it. They've started doing it, but it's still kind of a relatively new thing. So for me to get to interview them was as people was really, really cool. It was really awesome. And I got to film a bunch of concerts. And on that end, I got covered. Yeah. I got covered. I mean, and that was awesome. You know, they'd see me down there and they just, boo, here you go. Give me some extra spew. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, we always interview them as people. And that was really awesome. And that was one thing I was grateful that I had already done another documentary, because I feel like that's another thing that I am good at, is interviewing people, but not like I couldn't do what you do. Like, cause in documentaries, my voice isn't heard. Like I feel like I'm good at getting people into a conversation, and I've always kind of beat myself up for not being a real, like, no nonsense, you know, command, respect, badass kind of guy, you know, like those people that can just get shit done. But I think because I can kind of put people at ease, you know, because I'm not a threatening guy. I'm just kind of a unassuming little guy. And so, and you know, like you, you do your research, which is awesome. And I did my research. I never went in there just, so what's that one album that you did? You know, We Knew It All. And it was really cool. So they were really great, you know, and knowing in the documentary, we go into some dark places. And it was cool that they went there, that they were okay to go there. And that's gotta be hard. You know, I mean, I'm sitting here talking about fun stuff, but to talk about the stuff that they have to talk about on camera, knowing it's being recorded in front of a guy that, you know, you don't know that well. And that's really, I think that's one thing that makes the movie, is the emotion that these people show. I mean, it's pure and it's raw. When you see them, there's something about when you see a gruff guy start to cry. It's like seeing your dad cry. You know, you see, like, these guys are all, you know, they're, you know, they're rock and roll guys, you know? So, you know, that they're not dramatic people. They're not going to cry just for something. So it's really powerful. Like when I watch it, and particularly Brad Roberts, Jizmac, whenever I watch it and he tears up, it always, even though I've seen the movie 100 times, it always makes me tear up when I see him, you know, get teared up. So it was awesome. So it was different. It was a different experience.
Yeah. Well, I'll say one thing that really surprised me about the Gwar documentary. I'm a huge fan of the Descendants Bill Mitch documentary. One of my favorites. And it very much as it's a Descendants documentary, it's very much about the drummer, Bill Stevens. I assume you've seen it.
Yeah,
of course. And then the Nickelodeon movie was very much a Jerry Laybourne was the thread. Well, I expected the Gwar documentary to be a Dave Brocky documentary.
Yeah,
and right. I was both bummed and also excited that it wasn't, because there's definitely more to the story than just Dave Brocky. How did you find that level? How did you figure out that fine line of making it more about the band and less about him and his untimely passings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is one thing that helped me too. I did as much research as I could, and Gwar, Bob Gorman, who is just such an awesome, awesome guy. He's Bone Snapper, and he's okay. Been an artist in Gwar since he was a kid. He doesn't look old enough to be in Gwar for as long as he had, like Scum Dogs era, you know, and he just looks like a 30-year-old guy. It's like, were you in Gwar when you were five or what? But I mean, it's weird. You know, you look at him, you're like, oh yeah, you probably joined around 2000 or something like that. Nope, 80s. But he had written a book called Let There Be Gwar, and that was really good research. And that that's whenever we realized it. And then talking to them, so you'll see in the people listening in the doc, there's two interviews. Like, everybody got interviewed twice. So the first time we interviewed them, we were just kind of casting the net wide. You know, we had done our research and we were just casting it wide. And then we went home and watched those. And then we knew what to ask specific people, where to go with specific things. And we knew deeper avenues to go down. We were no longer asking all the members the same questions anymore. We knew what was up with different people. And in that first set of interviews, we just kind of, like I said, we just went in and it was super casual, just talked to them about the basics. It really solidified that it's the way to do this story is it's a collective. That's the first thing that made me want to do it, was finding out GWAR is not a band. They are an artist collective. And there was a documentary, I'll have to look it up, but the name always escapes me, but it was about the artist who did like the Pee Wee Herman stuff for the Pee Wee Herman show. And then he also did the Tonight Tonight video. And he's just this weird artist guy.
I think I've seen that.
But if you look it up, we could say it. But it's, I always imagine the GWAR doc being kind of like that. Like, that was how it popped into my head, which is nothing like a heavy metal doc. And that's what excited me. What is it called?
Beauty is Embarrassing.
That's it. Beauty is Embarrassing.
It's a great documentary. I haven't thought about that in a while.
Yeah, I love the way it looked. Now, the documentary didn't turn out looking a lot like that, but that's what I thought about when we were making it. That was my biggest influence when we were kind of thinking about it. And so we went into it going, it's an artist collective. That's what makes it cool and different. And people don't know. I don't think people think about it. You know, a lot of people know GWAR. You'll get this reference. I've said it before, but sometimes people, it doesn't land. But they're like Motorhead or the Misfits in that they're a band that everybody likes. You know, punk, metal, alternative, hipster, whatever. Everyone thinks GWAR is kind of cool. But, and then there's also the people that only know about them a little bit from Empire Records.
Right.
So, but you don't stop and think about it. You're just like, oh, that's the band that, you know, does the blood and the cum and they wear the costumes. So when we were like, it's an artist collective and the guys that make the costumes and build the props are GWAR every bit as much as the musicians. There's people in GWAR that don't play instruments. That was cool. And then once we're like, it really is a collective. That was the second part of, there is no Kurt Cobain of GWAR. There is no, as awesome as Dave Brocky was, and the guys in GWAR say this, like, it wouldn't have happened without him. I mean, because he was one of the creators, him and Hunter Jackson. And also he had that skill, that whatever it is, that magic that people have, you know, Jim Morrison, Glenn Danzig, people like that, that just have Henry Rollins, whatever it is that just like, you're awesome. You have to have somebody like that who can sell this weird idea. You know, if you hadn't had somebody that just takes it seriously, it's like, you can't go half in with a band about space barbarians that has have a huge cuttlefish that squirt blood on the audience or cum or whatever it is, and cut people's heads off. You can't half-ass that. You got to have somebody that like him that's bigger than life. But there's other people that GWAR would not have happened with as well. Hunter Jackson, he was making a movie that then combined with Dave Brocky's band. So those two were kind of like the John and Paul of GWAR. They were the two that were kind of the original two that made it, you know, and it was their two brains that kind of birthed GWAR. And they're two talents, you know. Hunter was making a movie. He knew how to make all these costumes. And then Dave was obviously a very talented musician. But then there's people like Don Draculich, who's most known as playing Sleazy P. Martini, GWAR's manager. He was the one that decided to make their costumes out of latex. Because you see in the documentary, and I think it's really cool because I think there's a lot of people that haven't seen it, their original costumes did not look like that. They were just like barbarian costumes. They didn't have any latex. They had no masks. They didn't squirt blood. They just kind of dressed up like barbarians. It was like paper mache and like leather or something. And Don Draculich was the one that started making it out of latex, which is what they're known for. And he's also the one that started spewing blood on the audience. So without him, never would have happened, you know? And then you've got, Michael Dirks and Brad Roberts, two very talented musicians. And Hello is a great record. It's really fun. But Scumdogs is the album.
Yeah, for sure.
And they were a big part of that, you know? And they're still in Guar to this day. So once you got those guys, their musicianship was able to take it to that next level. Had they stayed the way they were with Hello, would they have achieved the success that they did? Probably not. They would have been this fun idea. And then, you know, then you've got people like Matt McGuire and Bob Gorman, who have taken up the mantle since people like Hunter and Chuck have left, that it would have died without them. You know, Michael Bishop, who is, you know, still in Guar to this day. He was out of Guar for a long time, but now he's Berserker Blothar. I always say the Berserker Blothar, or I always say Blothar the Berserker, but it's the Berserker Blothar. But I think
he was the guy who shared his beer with me that day. I'll have to look at the video again. Okay. Yeah. Nice.
He was Beefcake the Mighty for a long time. Yeah. And he was the one that whenever Dave Brocky and them decided we need to get a real band, he was the one that recruited him. So Bob Gorman, who's still in Guar to this very day, and he's a crucial part of it, was recruited by Michael Bishop. Brad Roberts, Jizmac Nagusha, still in Guar to this very day, was recruited by Michael Bishop. Mike Dirks, Ballsack the Jaws of Death, recruited by Michael Bishop. So had Michael Bishop not been there, and he was the first good musician that they had, and he was really tied into the punk rock scene there. So he knew who to get. Whenever Brocky and those guys said, we need to get a real band. We need to get real guys that are good. He knew who to go to. And had they not had him, it wouldn't have happened. So there's all these people that it wouldn't have happened with. And Dave Brocky is one of those people. But there are other people that it would not have happened with. So that's where we knew that it was like, you know, Dave Brocky is, you know, arguably one of the main characters in the documentary, because he was one of the main characters in the story of Guar. Yeah. But he's not, like you said, it's not his story because he's just part of it.
Yeah. Are you ready to answer that question? It sounds like you're getting, that's going to be a question you get asked a lot, I'm sure. And it sounds like you've thought long and hard about how to answer that. And I appreciate that.
Oh, thanks. And that's one thing that we're telling people, and it'll be interesting to see how people react to it. It is a warts and all documentary.
Yeah.
It is it does the good and it does the bad. Well, you
don't learn things. You don't learn stuff from just positive, positive, positive. You've got to share some of the bad times in there too.
Some of the bad times. And, the Guar fans have seen it, but the majority of people that have seen it are film festival people.
Sure.
That are kind of Guar fans, you know, but the hardcore Bohabs, the majority of them have not seen it. So I'm really curious. In my hometown, I got some Bohabs together and watched it, and they really liked it. Like hardcore, like eat, sleep, breathe Guar, and they liked it. So I hope that Guar fans like it, because that was one thing that was the hardest thing. We wanted to make a documentary that served two purposes, and that is Guar fans will love it because you see more of what you love and you will learn things you didn't know. But also, someone that's never heard of them will like it too.
Yeah.
So we've seen that. We've seen people that don't know about Guar seem to like it. We've had a good response at all the film festivals we played at, but I want Bohabs to see it and to see what they say about it. Cause it's, you know, the same as the Descendants documentary. It shows the good and the bad. And I even watched a Foo Fighters documentary, and that's one thing that I liked. There was a part where Dave Grohl talks about it, how he went in and recorded all of it was the drummer for Sunny Day Real Estate.
Yeah, I can't remember his name either right now, but that scene is heartbreaking, and I'm so stoked it's in there. Yeah. That's a great documentary. I watch it often too.
It doesn't make Dave Grohl look awesome. He says it. He's like, I was an asshole for saying that. He didn't even tell him. I mean, it's one thing if you're like, dude, look, here's the thing. I need to record these again, but he just did it. But that makes you love Dave Grohl that much more because he's a human and he owns up to his mistakes. And, the Fat Records documentary, I loved the fact that you have some other punk rockers that kind of were like, these guys delegitimized it. You know, they went from it being this political statement to just about farting and stuff like that. And you know, people say, oh, you know, they had their sound. And it just made Fat Records look better. And it made Fat Mike look better because he handles that criticism. He's like, look, because I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you can talk about what's real punk rock and what's not. But I mean, NoFX got a shit ton of young people into punk rock that would not have gotten into it because those bands were already older and had broken up. And, you know, the Descendants weren't playing at that time. And so they got a lot of people into it and they opened it up to new people. A lot of people that were into thrash got into punk rock because they had that element. So, and they built a whole scene. So anyway, all that is to say is I think that it's stupid when you don't do warts and all. And, and that was one thing I learned with Nickelodeon. Nobody wanted to talk bad about them. And I kind of understand that because it's a huge corporation. And as a filmmaker, I wish I had gone in. That's one criticism I get with that. I think that's an awesome doc and overall people really like it. It's got a really good score on IMDb and Letterboxd, but that as a filmmaker, that's what I look back and I said, I wish I'd gone more into the warts with that one. So that was one thing going into this, I wanted to do that. And I just talked to the guys. I was like, what do y'all want to do? Because if it feels like a Guar commercial, nobody's going to like it outside of your fans. And we want to make this for new fans. And they agreed. They said, you know, Bob Gorman, they're all fans of documentaries because they're all these super hyper intelligent artsy guys. And they were like, yeah, we hate documentaries that were like that. So I just said, what do you not want me to go down? Because I'd rather us talk about it now than later, you know? And there was one thing that they said they didn't want to go down and we didn't go down it. And that's it. And it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't a big thing. It's not something that most people even care about, and that was it. And everything else, they said everything else is fair game. And you see it, there are some moments in there that make you go damn, you know, but that's what makes it cool. That's what makes them cool, that they did that.
Whenever I do an interview, I always try to learn something. I'm sure, and I've learned so much today. Thank you. I know that sounds like ass kissing, but I'm gonna take some real lessons away from this. What were some of, you know, coming from a DIY background and then doing this film about all these guys in this DIY background, was there anything that you learned from the Guar guys that you're going to continue using into the future?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking that. That's a great question. I don't know what it is, but with both of the documentaries that I did, my life started being a small version of what they did, you know, on a micro budget. But I was very inspired by Jerry Laybourne and the stuff, you know, like they talk about Ren and Stimpy, and it was just like, hey, some of the guys were like, oh, we play music so that doom 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 doom, you know, the theme song for Ren and Stimpy. They just did it. They're like, let's just do it ourselves. And that inspired me. I said, I got a lot of talented friends, so let's just bring them in. Why not? So one of my best friends, I was in a band with him in 1994, Jeff Johnson. He did all the animation. And he did a great job.
Yeah,
for the Orange Years.
That was one thing. I'm like, I've always wanted to make a cartoon, and in some sort of way, you made a cartoon. Like, fucking congratulations.
Thanks. And that was another one where he had never done that before. He had done other stuff, and he was really talented. But I knew that he could do it, and I knew that his style was right because he has that weird, quirky style. And so he did that. And then Darren Beck was, I was in an indie movie with Darren Beck a long time ago. And so I was like, hey, I just got a lot of my friends to do cool stuff. I wasn't afraid to do that because that's what they did. And also Jerry Laybourne found good people and then let them do their thing. She didn't micromanage them. Mm. And I was inspired by that. Like Darren, I didn't tell it. I said, just kind of make it sound like each show, make each show have their own thing. And he just did it. And I trusted him. And the editor Bradford, I just trusted him. You know, I didn't give him a bunch of notes. And so with Guar, big time, they influenced me. I mean, and the one thing was just their sheer work ethic. Those guys, they get to the show at 10 in the morning, 10 in the morning, and they start putting down carpet because they can't ruin the stage. And then they put down the like vinyl, whatever that clear, it looks like shower curtains over the monitors and the speakers. And then they start setting stuff up and then they meet their fans. They do a thing where the fans get to meet them out of costume, take pictures with them. And then they do sound check. Then they play the show. And then they get done around 1 in the morning and then they do it all over again for months. When you look at how long they tour, it's like 3 or 4 months every day, every day. And so for that, every time, like things that I couldn't do, I didn't think I could do, I did before, because I would just think, what would the Guar guys say? If I was like, oh, I'm too tired, they'd say, dude, look at what we do, you know? And so I just worked harder and harder because of seeing them do it. And yeah, I mean, so much of what they did inspired me. And the aesthetic of the movie, like we do this with that one, we do animation that's like comic books, because Guar is influenced by comic books. So their influence and style definitely helped me. And the DIY thing, to continue on doing it, hearing the stories of what they did, you know, I mean, on this movie, we were sleeping wherever we could sleep, doing whatever we had to do, working all night to get it done. But it was awesome. And yeah, so yeah, I learned a lot from them.
I went to Richmond a couple of years ago to see the Avail reunion shows. Mm. And we went to Guar Bar and we went to the Cobra Cabana. Yeah. And even, I think that guy might be in Guar sometimes, the Iron Reagan guy, but just to see I wish I knew now then what I know now, just so I could appreciate it. Guar Bar is awesome, but I would have appreciated it so much more to know what was gone into it. Mm-hmm. And it's cool. Hopefully this means more people will be checking out Richmond, which seems like it's kind of awesome nowadays.
It is. It's so cool. Like, you know, Austin is like, everyone talks about how it's a cool place in Houston, but man, when I went to Richmond, I was like, this is freaking cool. Cause it's got that just right amount of like danger and grittiness. So it doesn't feel like just a bunch of college kids that are starting beard oil companies and indie bands with their mom and dad's trust fund money. But yeah, Richmond is awesome. And the cool thing about the Guar Bar, if anybody goes right around the block, if you just go right around it, I mean, it's a 2-minute walk, is the dairy where it all started.
Oh, sure.
The milk bottle building that people will see in the documentary, it's right there. So yeah, you can go eat at the Guar Bar or drink at the Guar Bar, and the food is great. That's another thing. It's not they could have survived just off of the gimmick, but the food there is awesome, because there was one time when we were in Richmond and we were interviewing Guar all day, like all day, no break. And they got us food from the Guar Bar. And they pay full price when they buy it, because they don't want to get in the habit of getting free food. Like, that's what kind of people they are. When they buy their own meal, when the Guar guys go to the Guar Bar, they still pay, because they don't want to get in that mentality of, oh, it's free. But they bought us food. So I wasn't even there. I didn't even have the visual element of seeing all these things. We just ate it. And I was like, damn, this is great. And Michael Dirks, they're all multi-talented people. And Michael Dirks, he's kind of heads it up, comes up with the recipes and stuff. And it's great. Yeah, totally.
You're working on a movie with us. Is it Steve-O right now?
Yeah. So that's a documentary that I'm working on called American Clown. And it's pretty cool. It's all about the history of clowns. And and it's another thing that, like, Guar, like, you always see clowns and you're like, you either think that they're like super scary or like, what the hell is this? You know, some dude that's just got a nose on, but it's an actual art form and people go to college for that stuff. And it's like and it's going away because Ringling Brothers closed down and more people are freaked out by clowns because of all these horror movies. And so what would you do if the thing that you thought you were put on earth to do? Cause we've all felt like that. You're like, this is what I was born to do. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's a musician, actor, filmmaker, whatever. If the thing that you were put on this earth to do was no longer a thing. And that's, you know, these people, we go into that, like the clown college that these people go to. And then we kind of show how other people have, Steve-O went to Ringling Brothers Clown College.
Oh, okay.
And, but look at what he's done. You have to be a little more creative. He's not a clown, but he kind of is, you know, the stuff that he did with Jackass, he learned from being a clown and doing crazy stuff and entertaining people. So yeah, that's pretty cool. So it's kind of neat. We have Bear Margera in the Guar doc and then Steve-O in the clown doc. It's like, all we got to do is come up with another documentary about, and get Johnny Knoxville. And then we'll have like the trifecta of Jackass people. Maybe we'll do a Jackass doc. I don't know.
Well, and what's cool is clowns are DIY. Guar's DIY. You're DIY. Nickelodeon was very much DIY in the beginning. It's cool to see that thing, and good to see that you're sticking with it. What do you hope all these seeds that you're planting in the ground now, what do you hope they grow into for you? How can I help make that happen for you, sir?
Well, thanks for supporting the movies. I mean, that's a thing people can really help, you know, watch it,
That's a good question. Obviously, it's going to be better for you monetarily if I buy it versus just watching it on Hulu. But does me watching it multiple times on Hulu help you guys make more movies?
You know, it does. You know, Hulu paid us a flat rate.
Sure.
So it's not like I get paid for more, but I think that it does help, because then in the future, Hulu would take us more seriously. They would be like, oh, cool. Those are those guys that brought us a lot of viewers, or, you know, a lot of people. Cause it's one of the most popular documentaries. When you go to documentaries, it's on there. And Guar, we're doing it backwards with the Orange Years. You could rent it on iTunes and Amazon, and then it went to Hulu, went to a streaming service. With Shudder, it's going to be backwards. It's going to be on Shudder for about 3 or 4 months, and then it's going to go to iTunes, Amazon, where you can, for people that do want to own it, and it's going to go to DVD at that time.
Oh,
so great. You can buy a DVD, and we're working on a really great DVD with lots of special features and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I mean, and even like rating it on all that stuff, it just looks like, you know, rating it on Rotten Tomatoes, rating this stuff on Letterboxd, IMDb. It just looks like, you know, more, it shows people, unfortunately, that stuff does matter, and it shows people that, like, oh, this is a thing, you know, the people are into this. And yeah, for me, to answer your other question, what my next doc is, I hope I can still be DIY, but instead of this kind of make a documentary for a year of your life and then hope that you one day make your money back, which I haven't yet. and that's fine. That's not why I do it, you know. But have some, like, be able to go to HBO or Netflix or Hulu and go, hire me to make a doc from the get-go, and have a partner like that from the beginning, so that, you know, I can just up the production value and work on it like that, you know, because that's how some of my friends have done it. Once you've met, you're not a risk anymore. And I feel like hopefully I'm not a risk anymore. Like, you know, I'll make it, you know, if I have an idea, you know, I can make it even with no help. So if you come in and help me, you know, we can do something really cool here. As long as, like, I've had friends that have gone both ways, where they still let them use all their own people. And I've had other people say, like, no, you know, that once the corporate people come in, they're like, no, you're still the director, but we got our own cinematographers, our own editors, and that would be a bummer. So hopefully I can find that sweet spot of still using my own people, but just have that support from the beginning. You know what I mean? Because I have to work a day job and stuff like that, and I don't mind, but I think if I didn't, the documentaries would come out even better. You know, if I could say, this is my job, you know, I could work on it. The same amount of time I'm working on documentaries and day job, I could just do documentary and make it, you know, a lot better.
Oh, I hear you. I'm working two jobs, trying to do this. And I think I'm trying to pick up a third job, but they're all doing things I love and things I do for free. But man, it's hard to pay your bills these days and still do what you love. So, but congratulations to you on doing all this stuff. Anything else you want to throw out there before I let you get along with your day?
No,
before that's I go it. Off to one of my other jobs.
I'll just, the last little bit here, I'll just say, you know, we're doing a small theatrical run, a lot of Alamo Draft Houses. So if you want to see it before the 21st, there is that theatrical run. And then it'll be on Shudder and AMC Plus on July 21st. And then in October, it'll come out on DVD and for rent. And buy. So if you want to own it, that'll be a good time to do it. And Shudder will be doing that. So if, as long as you follow Shudder or follow Guar, you'll be kept in the loop and know when all this stuff happens.
Hell yeah, man. Well, Scott, it was, I mean this in absolute pleasure chatting today. I know you do a lot of these, so thank you for taking time out of your day to chat with me.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. And, you know, thanks to Guar. Thanks to Shudder. I hope everyone listening loves the movie.
Hell yeah, man. Well, Scott, it was, I mean this in absolute pleasure chatting today. I know you do a lot of these, so thank you for taking time out of your day to chat with me.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. And, you know, thanks to Guar. Thanks to Shudder. I hope everyone listening loves the movie.